Hey, and welcome back to another exciting episode of Extra Features Podcast. Today we have a film I've already reviewed on Twitter, which I very rarely do, and he still came on the show. The film is called Netflix vs. the World. Sean Coffin's in the house. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you. Yeah, you didn't hate my movie too much, so I figured, yay, let's talk.
Let me start this. I did not hate your movie at all. I was interested in your film. And for a film I knew nothing about and just sort of showed up one day, I'm like, this looks interesting.
That's awesome. How did you find the film?
Honestly, a friend of mine said there's a film about Netflix he read about and you should check this out. That's really how I found out about it.
That's awesome. Well, thank you for checking it out, because as an independent film, like, every view means the world.
And
I just wanted people to see your stuff. I mean, there is no marketing department behind this. It's just me and my partner.
Yeah, it's a solid, solid film. Okay, let's start off right at the beginning. We're going to ruin something for people. You have no Reed Hastings. It's probably my biggest issue.
Yeah. Trust me, we tried.
Oh, I'm sure you did. So tell me about that. Let's start out to ruin it for everybody. There's no Reed Hastings. I'm sorry, people. It annoyed me.
So we have all the founding team minus Reed Hastings. We reached out to him, and he responded that he was working on his own book, and he just wanted to concentrate on that and not, you know, it is what it is. It's a billionaire that can pick and choose what he wants to do. So, yeah.
But I got to give you guys credit. You guys did wonderful in-depth research.
Yeah, I mean, I have to thank my partner. I mean, how it started was I was working on my previous film, which is a documentary about the origins of Nickelodeon. And you know what they say, you never want to finish a product and not have another product going, because people are like, what are you doing next? And if you don't have anything to say, that's a bad thing. So during the process, I was kind of looking at, like, all right, what do I want to do next? So I had two different projects I was looking at. One, I wanted to do a documentary about Fred Rogers. luckily, I didn't go down that route, because I would have been beaten by an Oscar-nominated film. and then the other option was Netflix. And there was a book that I read called Netflix, and it was by a writer, Gina Keating, and I reached out to her about being in a documentary I wanted to make about Netflix, and she was like, actually, I've done a few interviews trying to do my own documentary in forces, and that's how we kind of got together. And so she had all the research, because she had done it for her book. She had went out, she had discovered who Mark Randolph was, because people didn't know who Mark Randolph was. It was all founder Reed Hastings. It wasn't co-founder Reed Hastings. And she found Mark, who was right there at the beginning with Reed, and they came up with the idea together.
So let's start with Mark then, because he's pretty much the cornerstone of the film. Without Mark, I don't think there's a film.
Right. He's the Wozniak. He is the, I mean, even though Reed Hastings is the analytical brain of it, and Mark's the creative type, he was just kind of in the roles that Reed, the Wozniak that became Steve Jobs, and Mark started out as the Steve Jobs about the creativity of, like, let's do this, let's try this, and everything, and Reed was very focused.
I would give Mark full credit, man. This guy is smart. He knew what he wanted, he knew what we needed to do, and he got it done. And he loves talking about it, which is even better. I don't know if Steve Wozniak likes to talk, but he loves to talk about his project.
Yeah, Mark's a great guy. And without Mark, like you said, most of the documentary just would fall apart.
So how is going to meeting Mark? I mean, you don't know what, or you've read this book, and you're walking into this meeting, and he just comes alive for you. Is that like your dream?
I mean, as anyone that's interviewed people, like, my previous life is I used to be an entertainment journalist. I would do a show that aired in Spain, so it was on the international side, but I did a lot of red carpets and celebrity interviews. And even before that, I did MTV, so I would do casting for an MTV reality show. And you can go from interviewing regular people and interviewing stars, and they're totally different. So when you have someone like Mark or the different people that we have in the film that are able to not be afraid of being in front of the camera and articulate, it's a dream for a filmmaker, because otherwise you're doing a lot of editing.
So I'm going to have to tiptoe around your film a bit. I apologize for that, because I want people to watch it.
Right.
So you understand what I'm asking about, and they won't, but they can check it out. I think we have to discuss the whole, I knew nothing about the Blockbuster online thing. Was that in the book, or is that something you stumbled on while you were creating this?
No, it's in Gina's book, but yeah, I mean, for me, that was the greatest thing that came out of this documentary is, it's kind of like everyone thinks they know the Netflix Blockbuster story. It's like everyone, oh, yeah, they didn't buy him for $50 million. Blockbuster was stupid. But, you know, as people learn when you watch the movie, like, Blockbuster came real close. And it was almost like a march to the bottom on price cuts and just burning through cash. And it was basically a game of chicken of whoever blinked first was dead.
Yeah, the chicken game is amazing in the film. I think everybody has to, like, sit on their edge of the seat for that. If you don't know anything about that, like myself, I think you create such drama with your cuts and your forward and back. Wonderful job on that.
Thank you.
Now, did you think it was weird when you're filming and you're interviewing and you find out from the Blockbuster exec that they just were allowed to walk into Netflix? Well, my jaw dropped at that point.
Yeah, I mean, I can understand. I mean, you think about it back in the day, like, Netflix is doing all they can to get press. And who wants to do a little startup company that, even in Hollywood, that wants to, you know, ship DVDs? That's not a sexy thing for press. So whoever wants to come in, you know, they're an open book. Now, Netflix isn't like that today, so they've gone full circle. But, yeah, I can understand why they did it. It's just crazy that you have all these spies around that are just in there copying verbatim of, like, how you run your DVDs through. How do you set up the warehouse? Yeah, I mean, it's a really fun aspect of the whole spy espionage on it when it comes to the whole Blockbuster online part.
So now we're going to go, I want to go a little bit more your filmmaking process. When you're going to interview somebody, you bring a light, one camera, or do you bring two cameras? Do you have a list of questions, or do you just have a general idea of what you're going to discuss?
Run it back. You froze. I didn't hear anything.
Oh, I'm sorry. When you go to do an interview, obviously you have a camera, some lighting. Do you do makeup at all on the people? Do you have your questions ahead of time, or do you just bring a free form? Okay, we're going to kind of touch on these topics. How do you work it?
So we had a full light kit. It was me and my friend Brian and Gina, and then sometimes it was Gina, the other DP of the film, Derek, and myself. Because sometimes when I had to, I would shoot, and when I could have someone else shoot, it would be easier because I could think about how I was going to cut. Because that's a good thing about being an editor also, is like as you're doing the questions and stuff, so Gina would ask the questions, I could think of how it would cut to what someone else said, or as I'm looking around, they might show me some photos from back in the day, and I could be like, oh, let's ask about that, because I have footage to show. That was the toughest thing about this, and this is what Mark told me he tells all entrepreneurs, is take photos. He goes, we didn't take any photos at the beginning, so we have no, like, visual representation of the early days of Netflix. So, like, every piece of thing, like, photo I could find was, like, gold for me, because you don't have video footage, you don't have any archival pictures, so you're trying to create this narrative that's just not talking heads the whole movie.
So, where do you get the photos from? Let's start there. You do great photos. I love the photos of the groups and them flying in to play. Like, you do have photos of them doing team grouping and meetings and things. So where do they come from? Are these from Mark or from everybody else?
They would come from different people. So someone would say, like, I had two photos. Other people would be like, I had three photos. Like the Nickelodeon documentary I did before, there was a whole lot more photos.
Well, I think with that, you'd find the...
Oh. And, there were kids. I'm just gonna fix it. It's like, you could get one photo from this person. What?
Wouldn't you say that if you're shooting a different... Nickelodeon's more of an entertainment base, so they would understand to take photos, I guess? Right. I mean, Netflix, in the beginning of the doc, doesn't even sound like they think they're going to exist 3 months.
Yeah, because it's just one of those things of, like, here's an idea, let's see if it works. And if the idea for Netflix had come a few years earlier, they would have never done it because it was impossible to ship VHSs, and the whole pricing model for VHSs made it not worthwhile. So it's just kind of like a lot of those Silicon Valley stories that it's just the right time.
Yeah, I think it was great. I also want to discuss, you have some great music. The Money song, I quite like.
Yeah, I got that from a site called Artlist.io. It's great for filmmakers because you can just pay one fee and get the music. Now, the score was actually done by a friend of mine. He is a professional composer. He does music for, like, God of War and different video games and stuff like that, and some TV shows on Hulu and stuff like that. But I knew Chris because he was the first baseman on our Hollywood kickball team when I used to live in LA. So it's all about connections.
I love it. I love it. Also under connections, did you use your animation connection to get your animation done?
Yes. That was Jeff, and Jeff actually did our animation for the Orange Years, the Nickelodeon documentary. So I asked him if he would come to the next project, and we just switched up this little style a little bit because we had a slightly different style in the Nickelodeon doc.
So I do have one question. You have some nice shots of inside the post office, especially when you're telling the story. Were they easy to get? Did you have to call the U.S. Post Office?
Yeah, you have to go through and ask for permission and get clearance, and then they gave us a site that had different footage that you could use to kind of tell the story. I mean, it's a great story for the post office, because without the post office, there is no Netflix. There's no streaming war right now.
Did you ever try to investigate who the Blockbuster employee was in the suit? I know the guy's John said it wasn't him.
Just multiple stories. As people will see, like, different people have different memories of what happened. So it's just, you got to figure out whose story makes the sense, but the essence of what went on. And I think we can talk about this story because the clip is online if people want to look at it on YouTube. Netflix rolls into Blockbuster's headquarters in downtown Dallas looking for a buyout because dot-com burst had just happened, and they're dot-com, and not a lot of people want to invest in dot-com. So it's kind of like one of those things of everyone looks with hindsight of, yeah, Blockbuster, they're idiots because they didn't buy Netflix for $50 million. Go back in the day and see if you're going to put down $50 million for a dot-com where all dot-coms just went broke. Or, I mean, Amazon dropped so much in their evaluation, which I was shocked that Amazon was, like, almost on their deathbed. So it makes sense in hindsight of why, if you're a big corporation, you're like, I'm not going to spend $50 million on something I could create for $5. Truly, they couldn't create it for $5, but in their mind, it's like, it's an internet site. I can make an internet site.
I do love how your film goes into the Blockbuster Netflix wars. I really think you set us up nicely for that. Like, you get in the background, I'm kind of like, okay, where's this going? And then you bring in the Blockbuster rental thing, which I knew nothing about. And then they keep going, John says something, boom, Blockbuster counters. I'm like, this is great cinema. Like, I really like that depth.
I think Netflix Blockbuster is probably one of the greatest, like, business battles of the 2000s.
Now, I guess I'm going to go back to what brought you on to do Netflix, of all things. I mean, you said you're doing the Nickelodeon, you read the book, but I don't know. It's just something that I would never have thought that was so rich in content. Yeah. Maybe the book gave you that.
It was the book. The book gave me all that drama. And honestly, I read a lot, but I read short form. I'm like reading news stories. I don't really read fiction. So I only read like three books since I graduated high school. And one was The Men Who Would Be King. I think that's the title. It's about the story of DreamWorks. The other one is Netflixed, which is Gina's book about, you know, Netflix. And then the other one was World War Z. So it was just kind of, I was just really inspired by the story. And I figured no one had done it. And if I could come in and make it, then it's hopefully going to live on as, you know, when people go back and try to watch the Apple story. It's just something that I thought Netflix had longevity and people would just go back as a business study or a documentary to find out how they got to where they were at. And also, when it comes to independent film, it's like if you don't have a big star, like forget about it, unless you're doing like a kid's film or you have like a dog in your film or you're making a horror film. Horror films don't need stars. But for documentary, you need something that everyone can relate to. And I couldn't think of anything else that people would relate to more than Netflix, because Netflix is in almost everyone's house.
So how did you, was the Netscape part of the movie that we learned right at the beginning, was that exact in the book or is that something you discovered on your own?
That was something that we added because we wanted to build context, because it's not like Netflix was at the beginning of the .com. It's Netscape is really that first story of the big, you know, rival that came up. But the thing about Netscape is their battle with Microsoft, they lost.
Oh, they got destroyed.
Which Netflix totally could have happened to them. So it was a great little something that you would think would foreshadow, but it kind of set it up of what Netflix could have went their path, but they didn't. I mean, the sheer fact that as we were making it, Netflix got passed by Disney for valuation. And then all of a sudden, you know, Disney shot past Netflix. And I was like, oh, I got to take it out because I have a part where they're like, you know, Disney passed Netflix, or Netflix passed Disney on evaluation, which is crazy. And I'm like, well, now Disney's shooting off. They have, you know, Disney Plus coming out. You know, all the Marvel movies are making bukus to bucks. But then COVID happened. And now Netflix is once again valued more than Disney. It's crazy. So that's the thing about documentaries. You can't time it because everything changes so rapidly.
So what was the one thing when you made the documentary that you were just like shocked at? I know what my big thing is, but I don't really want to mention it. But I'm sure you know what floored me. The big bomb in the film, it's the big one for me. What the blockbuster decision right at the end, which I'm not going to say. That was my big spoiler. I'm like, what?
Oh, about Jim Keys?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, there's stuff in there. I mean, that's the problem with the documentary is, like, you only have a limited amount of time. And this movie clocks in at, like, an hour 44, and that's cut down. I had to cut down scenes that are really interesting, cut down stuff in the streaming aspect, just because it's just so rich and so full, but you can't expect people to hang around like you're making a Martin Scorsese film, because it took me, like, a month to watch The Irishman because that movie was way too long. So there's always stuff on the cutting room floor. I appreciate the story about Netflix sending out Chinese porn instead of Bill Clinton's Monica Lewinsky testimony.
That was
pretty shocking that a company like that could make that big of a mistake and it not really affect them.
I like that story. The customer's apologies. Sorry, you sent me this by mistake and all sent it back. I thought that was pretty funny.
Yeah.
So I'm now going to have to ask, how much did you leave on the cutting room floor? Like, what did you cut some of the programmer out? Like, him and his wife aren't really showcased a lot.
The programmer?
The guy that, yeah, engineer, I think
Boris?
He is. Yeah, it's Boris.
I mean, just think about everyone you saw. I interviewed for an hour to an hour and a half. So that tells you how much footage I have. It's just all about finding the story and narrative arc. Like, we had to go back and kind of find out, like, what was happening at that time to put it in context. Because when they're talking about putting stuff on the Super Bowl, okay, it's been so long, so you don't know, like, what's happening in the world. I mean, if you look back at Netflix, I mean, Netflix has taken off during really hard economic times. I mean, after 9/11, they started taking off. After the Great Recession of 2008 is when they started really taking off. And now during COVID, you know, everyone's at home. What are they doing? They're watching Netflix. What's happening? Their competitors are getting killed because they can't have things in the theater. Theme parks are closed. So it's Netflix is just set up to, like, thrive, but really thrive during times of, you know, conflict.
How did you feel about driving up to a Best Western and shooting a Best Western? Do you just sort of show up and shoot it, or do you ask, or you just do it?
Well, we shot it from a street, so it's public. Just like my footage of the Netflix headquarters in Hollywood, not their headquarters, but their production headquarters. Like, you just shoot it from the street because it's all public spot. You know, if I went up to Netflix, they would have told me to get the hell off their property if I wanted to shoot. So it's just one of those things. You just make sure you don't get, like, people in the shot. Like, if you see there's a guy getting his car, but it's the back of his head. So it's just the guerrilla filmmaking way. Like, there are things you can ask for permission from that when you have to shoot in spots or organizations that you have to reach out to get permission. Like, we had to get permission for the Blockbuster content. Like, the Blockbuster guys had a lot of old, like, internal documents that they had and everything like that. So you had to get permission to, you know, use that sort of stuff. And then other stuff, you just have to make sure that you're using it legally, and you're not just going out there and being like, I love House of Cards. I'm just going to put 15 minutes of Kevin Spacey talking in this movie.
I love it. When you are doing logistics for your film and interviewing people, how long does that take?
Well, we kind of had to set it up as a path because I don't live in California anymore. And my writer producer, she lived in St. Louis at the time. So we would, like, we flew into LA and we kind of, cause I had different journalists that were in the shoot. So we would have different people that we'd have set up. And then I would try and fill the gaps with, like, journalists or stuff. And then I would kind of try to map it out so we could drive to this location, this location, this location. And then we drove all the way up to Silicon Valley and we hit people there on a path. So it's just trying to figure out how to be most efficient, because in any independent film, like, your budget is your own. So every delay you're doing is your own cash. Cause like I said, like, people were afraid of this film just cause they're afraid of Netflix. I reached out to different, show creators that had, like, their big breaks with Netflix, or, you know, different actors of color, or because I realize this is a Silicon Valley story. So it's just going to be a lot of, you know, white guys at Silicon Valley. So I try to get other perspectives. And then a lot of people just said no, because they didn't want to pit Netflix. And the intention was never to go into make Netflix like some, like, 2020 feature about, like, you know, sweatshops. It's just about the love of film and this company that has changed how we consume content.
That's amazing. So you went after people and they said no because they were afraid of Netflix.
Yeah, I mean, we had one film festival that was a good size that said Netflix is a platinum sponsor, so we can't touch the movie, but good luck. Like, one of those things. Like, so, like, even getting into film festivals, people would be afraid, because even though people have seen the movie, and if you see the movie, like, Netflix looks great, like, Blockbuster, you know, they're good rivals and everything. It's not like a, like I said, one of those investigative journals about, like, locking people in closets and beating them with whips. It's a good business story about, like, just ingenuity and, like, not quitting, but people are just afraid of someone with probably one of the top three buyers of content.
I find that shocking. I mean, if you ever came to me and said, do you want to do an interview? Sure, I'll do anything. I don't care. I have no fear of anybody. I'm like, what are they going to do, cut me off? Like, I couldn't care. My Netflix subscription's over. I'll live. So is your next idea for a thing, are you going to go to, like, a Disney Plus or something? Or, well, I guess you told me to ask you, what's next?
While I was making this film, it actually gave the idea for my next film. which is now going to be a docuseries. It's on a little show. Maybe you've heard of it, The Office.
I will shock you now. I've never watched an episode of The Office.
Oh, you're one of like 10 people in America. So when I was doing the documentary, I discovered that before Netflix adjusted their analytics and their back end and all that, that Friends and The Office were the two top shows watched on Netflix. Now, even though they changed how their analytics and how they score, if you still go on there, The Office is still like number 8, number 7, number 9. It rotates on the most binge show or content on Netflix. So that just showed the popularity. And I've always been a huge fan of The Office. So that's what got me interested of like, how did the show really come into being and stuff like that. So I got a chance to sit down with like Paul Feig, who of course Bridesmaids and Freaks and Geeks and stuff like that. Kevin Reilly was actually the guy that was over at NBC that greenlit The Office and fought for it season 2 and then got fired on top of it. But yeah, so that's kind of what I was in the middle of before COVID hit. So yeah, it's kind of not a behind the scenes of the show, but more of a exploration of the fandom of the show. Because if anyone's used memes or GIFs or things like that, you've probably used something from The Office, from like fire drill where they're running out, or all the that's what she said, or things like that. Like, even if you're not a fan of the show, you know of the show.
I do know of the show. I know friends that really like it. So we're getting to the end of my show, and I always ask people 3 fun questions before they leave.
All right.
And I know you've studied up on them. First one, your favorite film, because it's your first time you've been here.
All right. Well, can I give you 3?
You can give me 10. Go ahead.
Okay. All right. So I always give these people my 3 favorite films. So my favorite film of all time is, of course, Shawshank Redemption, which everyone loves, and I don't have to explain why it's so great, but that's the perfect film to me. But then I have a favorite action film and a favorite comedy. So my favorite action film is Die Hard. That, like, I can't imagine a better, like, I love so many action films, but Die Hard is just like, I can watch it all the time. And then a movie that my wife hates, but I can watch all the, like, even more than Die Hard, is Dumb and Dumber. Like, the ability to quote that film or just, you know, say things and then people can relay it back to you. It's kind of, I guess, what people have with The Office. But yeah, Dumb and Dumber, Die Hard, and Shawshank Redemption. And then if I got to add 2 more, it would be Braveheart and The Dark Knight. Chris Nolan's a top director for me.
One film you always recommend people to watch and they never have?
Ooh, that's a good question. Memento.
Great
Chris,
film.
Chris Nolan.
Yes.
Like, the sheer fact that it probably has one of my favorite moments of a movie, and it's just coming out of his blackout, and he sees a guy, and he thinks maybe he's chasing the guy, and then the guy turns around and fires at him. It's like, that joke only works in that movie at that spot, and it can never work in another movie. That's how genius that movie is.
So the last question is, one film you've never seen and should have?
See, that I wouldn't know, because if it's a film that I should have seen, I feel like I'd see it. Although I always have people like, you haven't, okay, so I haven't seen Deer Hunter or Taxi Driver, and people are like, you should see those films, but I don't know.
There, one you should see, one you could pass on. I'll leave it at that. I'll recommend a film. Have you seen Food Inc.?
No, I have not.
There's an awesome documentary on food.
And that's, I love Fistful of Quarters, I think that is. The Donkey Kong.
Oh, that's King of Kong. Absolutely.
King of Kong. Yeah, that was the subtitle. Yeah, but King of Kong. I love that doc.
That is a fantastic doc. Now, before we wrap up the show, if I ever played Donkey Kong and didn't deal with my kid, my wife would have killed me. It's my favorite scene in the King of Kong. So we can find your film on Amazon Prime, and I don't know where else it is, so this is a good time to tell us.
Yeah, I mean, we just wanted to release it on Amazon to begin with, One, because we thought it would be funny.
It's true.
Because if Netflix wasn't going to pick it up, let's just go to Amazon, because it's kind of funny to tell people to see Netflix's documentary on Amazon. When we first released the trailer back in the day, like, that was people's joke, like, available on Amazon Prime or Hulu and stuff like that. And then I was like, well, if you're going to be joking that way, might as well go with it.
I love it.
So, yeah, for right now, you can get it on Amazon.
Okay. Well, thank you for your time and have a great evening.
Awesome. Thanks for having me.
Hey, I just want to say thank you for listening to this great interview. We have more on our website at www.extrafeatures.ca. And if you enjoyed it, can you please go to iTunes and leave us an iTunes review and like us on our Facebook page? Thank you.